Okay, shall I start? This has nothing to do with the talk, but it's left over from yesterday. In the discussion of the whether you could have a needle that could have an equilibrium position that was neither perpendicular nor parallel to the plane. And I mentioned this paper by Kim Milton and his students, which came out in the October 17th issue of Physical Review Letters. It deals with dilute dielectrics, not Dirichlet scalars, as I said yesterday. And what they consider is a rectangular slab, perfectly rectangular cross-section, with a finite thickness. So it's not the same as this. But then they find that the equilibrium angle of that thing can be essentially anything, depending on the ratios, the two ratios of the lengths involved. And of course, there are regimes in which it becomes perfectly perpendicular and so on. Also, there's in the next issue, the November 7th issue, there's a paper by Diego. Is he here?
Yeah.
Yeah. and the MIT group working with Rodriguez, Johnson, Picasso, and so on, where they study a situation where they have a square and it turns out to have a 45 degree angle. So sort of related to that. Okay, now for the main event. thank you for showing up. For the people in the fluctuation program, I thank you for following me on what some of you will probably think an excursion into cloud cuckoo land, because I not only will I not be considering the Casimir effect for real materials for part of the time, I'll be considering a Casimir effect without any materials whatsoever. And I'm grateful to the Institute and the program for the generous financial support for my visit here. Okay, so what I want to talk about at the moment exists as a brief preprint by me and Klaus Kirsten, who's my neighbor at Baylor. And if we and the rest of the world decide that it's worth it, there may be a longer follow-up paper later. But this is this remark is actually a comment on someone else's paper. So to put it neutrally, I'll say building on papers by Hung Bo Cheng. Physics Letters B, most recent one, just came out, I think it is in August. Also, there's a similar remark to our main point is made in passing by Edery and Marachevsky, and another preprint that we didn't know about until we had finished writing ours. I think this is actually a KITP preprint. From this program. Edery was here sometime when I wasn't. Okay, before explaining what he did and what we're saying about it, I'd like to go back to a little bit of history, to the classic derivation of the Casimir effect. I don't remember exactly what Casimir himself did in his original paper, but I'm sure all of us have seen derivations of the Klassmer, the Klassmer attraction between parallel plates that starts with a picture that looks something like this. If you look at any of the treatments that go back to the 50s and 60s by Fiertz, Timothy Boyer, E.A. Powers' book, and so on, they're all always very careful to make everything finite by putting the whole thing into a box, finite in both directions, and then they fairly quickly take the transverse dimension to infinity so that the sum over transverse vectors becomes an integral. I'm not going to go through all of this because I assume that everybody here is already familiar with the Casimir effect at the level of, say, Dr. Gambassa's talk last week. So I won't compete and join the competition for an online picture, but that's what I have in mind. Then you take L to infinity and you find that what happens in this big chamber doesn't really have too much, and so you end up with just the attraction between two infinite parallel plates. So these people, of course, in the 1960s, they may have known that they were speaking prose all their life, but they didn't know that they were studying pistons, right? Because nobody had used the phrase yet. But that's what they were doing in terms of the terminology of the past 10 years. But in the meantime, I think it's fair to say that people became so accustomed to the result and the nature of the result that they began to do similar calculations without being so careful about putting on all these finite dimensions. And in particular, that was what Dr. Cheng did in his first paper. He said, "Let us investigate the influence of Kaluza-Klein dimensions in space-time on the ordinary Casimir effect." So he's going to look at ordinary metallic plates in a three-dimensional universe, but the universe also has small, compact dimensions, which means that instead of these, we now have something like that going around, and now instead of waves like this, we have waves going around like this in the other dimensions. Now, this sort of a calculation of the Kaluza-Klein effect on the ordinary Casimir effect needs to be distinguished from some other things that you find frequently in the literature nowadays, such as studying Casimir energy in the compact dimensions themselves and trying to see whether that could be an explanation for the dark energy. Or other people look at Casimir energy between Randall Sundrum brains, regarding them as somehow like plates. But that's more exotic than this. This is the actual Casimir effect between ordinary plates in the visible universe. But he says, let's do this calculation, including all these transverse dimensions, which I'll take for the moment to be periodic, just to add on a torus. And what he found in his first paper was that the Casimir force became repulsive at large distances between the plates. And not only repulsive, but it approaches a non-zero constant. And here's a read.
Little a large, is that
what? Little a large. large separation.
Could you answer one question? I mean, most of this has to do with space, but suppose Minkowski space, for example, was identified periodically in time. Would there be a Casimir energy flow?
Periodically in time.
It's a temperatureless case.
When?
One of the possible realizations of temperature would have early.
Temperature is because of periodicity and imaginary time. I don't want to say quantum field theory becomes rather problematical when you have closed time like Kerr.
Okay.
In lots of ways, not just Casimir effect.
I would say yes, because you throw out some of the modes. Yeah. You have to, your frequencies are discrete. It's the same thing about putting in the box.
You don't have a good initial value problem either.
But
you leave that to Bernard Kay and Mr. Fuster. I think they're the ones, the people who believe it, who are trying to do non globally hyperbolic things. I have no strong feelings about it.
Maybe I missed it. So, but they were considering which field, which boundary conditions.
I should have said that Chang and also most of the other people that I will mention accept these. Are doing scalar fields, and if you, one reason is that if you, when you do electromagnetic fields, going from scalar to electromagnetic involves more work in this case than otherwise, because you have a vector field in this higher dimensional universe, and so you have lots more components. You have components of the vector field pointing in these other directions, and they give rise to effectively massive vector fields when you reduce back to the three-dimensional space. And so, and that's the main topic of this paper, in fact, is what they call the Proca effect for electromagnetic fields in higher dimensions. But I think that the basic issues would still be the same. So we'll stick with the scalar field model for now.
What if the theory was supersymmetric?
Supersymmetric.
Well, then does it
act? I know that people appeal to supersymmetric theories to get rid of the zero point.
Just my vacuum
point. Energy.
Yeah, so. Does the Casimir effect exist in supersymmetric theories?
Yes. Yeah. Because.
Okay.
I don't know the answer to that question. I've never looked at the fermion.
The boundaries can interact in a different way if you bring them.
Of course. I've been waiting for the other party to interrupt. I was going to have a stopwatch to see how long it would take before somebody asked, when you're doing vacuum energy in a periodic universe, what is fluctuating, what is inducing, and what is interacting? There's no matter anymore. So, we're not doing van der Waals forces because the polarizable atoms have completely disappeared from the picture. But nevertheless, if you believe the quantum field theory, you have to the bookkeeping surely has to be the same as it would be otherwise. So in fact, the quantized field is indeed interacting with the geometry, with the gravitational field, and so this energy will have some kind of an effect on the expansion of the universe in principle. So there was another question.
Yeah, well, but I don't understand this statement you wrote on the board. That the force becomes repulsive at large distances A, but without any reference to B. What if I just let B go to zero to get rid of the dimensions?
I always get confused about B zero versus
whatever you call the internal dimension. What is the internal dimension? I just
mean
the internal dimensions.
There is
zero.
That's one of the more. Let me postpone that to the second follow-up paper. This all started out because I wanted to make a brief comment on Cheng's paper. It's qualitative. And I checked with Klaus, and he became very interested in the problem and began doing much more detailed calculations. And Chang's papers and also the others that I'm going to mention in a moment all do zeta function calculations. And Klaus is very experienced in zeta function calculations, so he's handling most of the detailed calculations. And in particular, there are things that we already know how to say that deal with what happens when B gets small and what happens when B gets large. And Tony, I promise I will look in my preprint and my manuscript later on and try to answer that, but I'd rather not get into it right at the moment. Well, one thing I wanted to say was that Chang's immediate reaction to this was, this result is obviously wrong physically, therefore I have proved there are no Kaluza-Klein dimensions. That was what he believed in 2006. But then somebody told him about pistons. So he said, I should redo the calculation making this universe a piston. Now to him, making it a piston meant adding the third plate at the end, out at infinity, and taking account of the energy in here. When he did that, of course, anybody who's familiar with the papers of Cavalcanti and Hertzberg drawn on pistons will know that this went away because it was canceled by something from the outside going in the other direction. And so that's what he found. Okay, since non-vacuum energy people showed up, I imagine I should say something about the, I don't have the full references, but I should say something about the piston literature. Okay, Hertzberg, Dr. Kardar?
Yes.
You in this list? Yeah. Okay. Cavalcanti did the scalar field in two dimensions and drew precisely this picture before I mucked it up, and this MIT group did it in three dimensions, extended to, I can't draw a cube at that low altitude, just believe I drew a cube there. extended to the electromagnetic field, and also gave an interpretation of the various contributions to the force in terms of classical paths for solutions by the method of images. So that it becomes clearer than it was in Cavalcanti's original paper what is happening. So what we can now say is that I left out, I guess, a bit of history in between after Fiertz and so on, when I said people began ignoring the smaller dimensions. In between, in 1971, there was the famous or notorious paper of Lukács, which did a finite rectangular parallelepiped and found a repulsive force for certain aspect ratios for the rectangular piped, including for the cube. And this is considering nothing but the energy inside, not considering anything that might be acting on the body from outside, and it's been subject to a lot of criticism. And in fact, this piston was introduced by Cavalcanti precisely to create a situation where you had a rectangular cavity, but nevertheless you didn't have to consider any deforming bodies. You could just consider the movement of this partition back and forth, you have two decoupled bodies and ask what the balance of forces is. Any divergences that occur at the walls cancel out. And if you look closely at the solution in terms of the classical paths or methods of images, you find that in some sense the source of the repulsive force, and this I'll use the big picture up here, comes from paths that go like that. And the fact that it's asymptotic, the force is constant, means the energy is linear in A for large A. And it's basically just the Casimir energy of the attraction between this and this, which is negative. And so the partition would like to move out, right, to minimize the energy. But when you have this plate fixed and this one moving, then you have just as many paths on the outside, which are giving a contribution in the other direction, moving the energy associated with these side plates doesn't depend on the position of the plate in between. So this force on the Lukacs force on the inside can be thought of, as these people say, as an artifact of neglecting the what's happening on the outside. Okay, so I think that basically makes the points I wanted to make there. Okay, well, so I thought it was worthwhile to restate what Chang had said. I didn't think his paper was particularly clear. To him, making a piston means adding the third plate. To me, making a piston means adding the compact extra dimensions, and then you have to consider what's on the outside in order to get rid of this spurious repulsive force. So you really need both. You need compact extra dimensions to create the paradox of a repulsion, and then you need to consider the outside chamber to get rid of the paradox. Both of them are important. Okay, so now I want to stress why I think this is something worth worrying about in terms of the existing literature, because there are other papers those are the ones that I know about. and these are people who are doing, again, this ordinary Casimir effect in a universe with extra dimensions. Sometimes extra small dimensions, sometimes Randall Sundrum brains, and sometimes both at once. They all do the calculations by zeta functions. And Klaus, so far, has been frustrated in trying to reproduce it. As I say, he's very familiar with the zeta function calculations, but he can't understand their starting points. One reason why I'm giving a talk like this instead of one with a projector is there would be no middle ground here between being qualitative, as I am, and being ridiculously technical. If I wrote equations, they would be long, impenetrable sums of Epstein zeta functions and modified Bessel functions and so on, and you wouldn't want to look at them.
Yeah, it's curious to hear about all these things. I'm one of the co-authors of a third paper.
Oh, you, this one or this one?
No, this one.
This one.
I've been in contact with Klaus last week. He pointed out a few mistakes, and I mean, he was very helpful in order to try to get our results right. So, and I would like to talk to you about all that since you're interested in this work.
I have not had time to study this at all. But are very very much so. But I'm, of course, I'll be happy to help with you, to talk with you. You can correct me if I'm mischaracterizing yours, but I think it's fair to say that the others all. all do the same thing that Chang did. They ignored the piston aspect of life, right? But they did not find the repulsive force. And so, as I said, simply because of the magnitude of the task of trying to reproduce the results, we don't know whether they simply didn't look numerically at large enough A to know to notice that this was happening, or whether we don't understand what they did and what they did was actually something different from what we think they did. But the problem in this field is there. Not only are these zeta function formulas very complicated, there's no canonical form for them because there are lots of identities that relate them, and so you have two vastly different expressions that could actually be the same and not know that they're the same without doing a lot of work. So that's what we're. And I think most of these papers present some numerical calculations, but concentrating on small a, because that's the regime that's experimentally relevant. So if Klaus is working, trying to bring some order into the chaos, and then there may be another paper that contains the detailed results. But certainly, this is something that should be addressed, because I think, again, excluding this group, not just because a member is present, but because I know that at least one of those people that I already knew is active in the vacuum energy community, named Farina. The others, I think, are people who are not vacuum energy people, but cosmologists, string theorists, astrophysicists, or something, who probably are not up to date with what's going on down here.
The first paper quotes, and this is all four, the first paper quotes Sparnai experiment as a very precise measurement of the cosmic.
I noticed that. I thought that was quite interesting. It was a little bit out of date. Okay, so this is a field, a subfield that needs and deserves some help. So I think we need to get into that. Okay, so what else was I going to say? Okay, so there's a mystery of why they didn't find the repulsive force doing it. All these other people. And another issue that we don't understand, and maybe some people here can enlighten me, I can't make a blanket statement about all of them, but because they're all different in what they looked at. But Chang certainly gives the impression that he's talking about periodic extra dimensions. But when he writes down the zeta function, or the sum over normal modes, what he writes down is the proper sum for an interval with Neumann boundary conditions, not a periodic, not periodic boundary conditions. Now, it doesn't make much difference. It's just a treatment, a factor of two in how you treat the zero mode relative to the others and how you normalize B. But still, it's sort of strange that he wrote down something that, to those of us who do this sort of calculation all the time, is an obvious error. Now, he seemed to be following from here. You go back to these people, they also write down the same spectrum, but they say we're working in a Z2 orbifold, which I take it means that it's periodic, but it has an additional symmetry, which makes the symmetry the same, the spectrum the same as for Neumann boundary conditions. And I'm looking over in this corner for some confirmation of that.
Is the ambiguity, right, that these people find due to the ambiguity in the regulation scheme? That is, in state of function regularization, say that, right? Delta of 0 is equal to 0. Delta prime of 0 is equal to 0. And therefore, you can add back extra pieces of delta 0 and get a different finite part. Is that what it's all due to?
From my point of view, the importance of the significance of zeta functions is that if you do a calculation with the zeta function regularization, then and if the zeta function has no pole, which corresponds to saying that if you did it the way I would prefer with an ultraviolet cutoff, there are no terms that are logarithmic in the cutoff, just negative powers in the cutoff, then that automatically, by black magic, removes all the divergences. Now, in a situation like this, nobody cares because the divergences are guaranteed to cancel out in the calculation of the force anyway. But if you're doing what Lukács was doing, then he's ignoring all of the divergences that come from, in my picture, paths like this that bounce off the wall and give you a very large negative energy density right next to the wall, which obviously depends on the surface area of the box. And that's been being completely ignored. And the long history of recriminations about that in that model and in the Boyer sphere and so on. So if you do it with an ultraviolet cutoff, you at least know that you're throwing it away. I compare it to the full disclosure approach to political corruption. You can take any bribe you're offered as well, as long as you're willing to make it public. So anyway, so I was trying to answer Jim's question, but now I forgot. Okay. So anyway, we don't understand why they write down a Neumann spectrum instead of a regular spectrum, because apart from this one, the other two and Chang are clearly, it seems to us, not they're clearly doing it for dimensions that are not Z2 orbifolds, but something else. And we don't understand what's going on there. But we're not prepared to say that they're wrong without first having some communication with them. But in any case, the main point turns out to be roughly independent of such details, because you can see that any internal space, whatever, is going to give essentially the same result. You might have an internal space where the internal Casimir energy turns out positive instead of negative, and in that case, this force would be a big attractive force instead of a repulsive force, but that's the only difference. And that's, in some sense, irrelevant because we're saying that's the wrong way to do the calculation anyway. So that's basically what I have to say about the Kaluza-Klein pistons. I'd like to bring up something else as a third act. to perhaps stir up a little bit of controversy in a second. But first, I'll stop and see if anybody has any comments or questions.
So the vacuum energy associated with these small extra dimensions is probably much bigger than this change in the ordinary Casimir force. But that's just being subjected out. I mean, that doesn't contribute to this, the effect you're looking for?
Well, I would say that in some sense, this repulsive thing is the vacuum energy corresponding to the transverse dimensions. It's the derivative of that with respect to little a. And that's why it's a proper piston calculation calculation cancels it out because you also have
the end of the world instead of being just a boundary unit.
Oh, I see. So what is the final answer that there is no effect?
Well, I think clearly, if you have this compact dimension inside your apparatus, you also have your compact dimension outside, right? So you have to consider it. Now you might query what is this third plate somewhere out at the end of the universe, but I think it's just a matter of doing bookkeeping. It's a question of if you don't have it there, then you think of this whole thing as being somehow pushed out, and that's just subtracting infinity from infinity is always a tricky business, right? It's an issue. But it seems that the safest way to do it is to put a spatial cutoff in there, and then you have just as you lose just as much on this side as you gain on the other side, and so this.
But the important thing is also that you keep L finite, right? To the very end, only then you take L to infinity. Because otherwise, I think you will also lose that trick.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. I think taking it to infinity is the same thing as never having it there at all, right? It amounts to saying here's an infinite thing, and if you move it over, it's just as infinite before as it was afterwards. But that's not good.
What did Casimir do or not do that they considered inadequate and they wanted to do it this way?
What did Casimir do?
Yeah, you can't just do it the way he
did. Oh, Lukács, you mean?
No, Casimir.
Casimir.
Nobody seems to fuss about all his attractions showing up. I think they're posting showing up. Oh,
as I said, I didn't.
I'm probably going to have to discuss. Casimir did something similar in this paper, in this original paper.
He basically had a box.
He had a box with a rod.
And he deformed the box, and he sort of, this is a plank with geometry. Sort of like Black Friday.
As so often happens, other people come along and redo the original paper in ways that are cleaner, clearer, and so on. And I think one of the most important ones is a paper by Fiertz that came soon after Casimir that was a simplified version of the calculation that is widely read. And then essentially the same thing was repeated by Boyer in his big Annals of Physics paper in 1970, when over does, and Power.
What did they
in his book,
find but, wrong with Casimir?
I don't think there's anything wrong with it. It's just a way of redoing the calculation that is a little bit more pedagogical and perhaps more rigorous. And I'm sorry, Casimir's paper is so hard to find. You can't just go out on the web and get, as far as I know, and get
it. It's impossible. It's on the web, but we can.
I didn't try to see what he did.
It was pretty short, using Bernoulli formulas. Something very, very easy. Yeah, there is no
complication. The demo was generalized. People didn't worry about that. Mm-hmm. And come back to the special case.
I don't think anybody ever complained about Casimir's paper being wrong. They complained about Lukács being wrong.
Okay. But Lukács presumably found something wrong with Casimir.
No, Lukács is doing a different situation. He's doing a genuinely finite cavity. Okay.
But just the takeaway message is, what is the force, right? Lukács-Kruse.
Yeah, the conclusion of all these piston calculations, which includes Cheng 08, is that this implausible long-distance repulsion cancels out, and what you have left is an attraction in the sense that it, in this piston situation, the partition is always attracted to the nearest end.
And it's 1 over a to the fourth or something independent of b?
No. In general, it's an Epstein zeta function, which, in fact, that's what I should have answered Tony's question. How I should have answered Tony's question. Unfortunately, he's not here anymore. But you have sums of things that look like.
Scales should be
the Epstein zeta function is something like this, raised to some squared, I guess. So, of course, all these things depend on whether we're talking about energy or force or
like
what have you. But
torus
or so if you go to if B is very large, then most of the terms will just be that, and you get your usual fall off as A to the fourth. If B is very...
You're quoting the force, the attractive force, not the potential.
Again, that depends. This is something I wrote down off the top of my head. And I tried to disclaim it by saying nuts. But this is the right dimensions to be the force, I think. 1 over a to the fourth.
Yes.
Right? Okay. So the energy would be something else. Now,
it's basically a superposition of massless of massive scalar fields, right? And very short separations. The masses don't play a big role. The full observation will freeze out and conclusion of the massless scalar field is left over.
Okay, if B is very small, then you can show that you can essentially ignore the small dimensions, which is what you would expect, and you get back to the usual situation. If B is very large, then you have to treat those dimensions just like you treat those as essentially infinite dimensions. You're back to this situation, and you get the dependence that would be appropriate for that dimensional space. So if B is very small, then you count only this dimension and whatever additional large dimensions you have. It depends on how you interpret this picture. But if this dimension is Kaluza-Klein, or if this dimension is orthogonal dimensions in three space.
So the dimension would be then a crossover between a force which falls down like 1 over L to the 4th to 1 goes 1 over L to the D, where D now is the sum of all the extra dimensions.
Right.
Yeah.
And the size of the Kaluza-Klein? The compact dimensions plays no role, is that right?
No, what he said, it interpolates.
See,
if B is very large, then you have to count those dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'll get L, get A to the minus D, where D is the total dimension involved.
Oh.
If B is very small, you can ignore those dimensions, get A to the minus 3, just for the three dimensions of space. This would be for energy. So D is equal to 3 plus little d, the number of internal dimensions. And if B is something finite but macroscopic, then you get something that's not a power law. It's like something like this.
And some factors of pi probably you get extra, right?
Oh, okay. Come on, Andrew.
Does that mean that
we're lucky to get the exponent right?
Does that mean that very delicate experiments of measuring the Casimir force could detect extra dimensions?
Well, I think that's what all these people were ultimately concerned about.
What's the story, right?
Not yet there.
So how far off does the present experiment?
Well, present experiments, unfortunately, are real materials. Present experiments are, unfortunately, with real materials. Yeah. And the material properties change the answer so much anyway.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see. The exponent is not far in real experiments.
In the exponent of A, 1 over yeah. something. Mm-hmm.
3.7.
Really?
At least this week.
That's 3.7 where it should be. 3.7 where it should be 4, right? Yeah. So this doesn't help. It goes the wrong. The Kaluza Klein well, dimensions where they could go the wrong direction.
And we're reaching where the cosmic effect should be 4. It's very difficult. It's small and temperature is also.
Okay, let me just step into the lion's den a minute and see what the consensus here is. Okay, so suppose I want to try to vindicate Lukacs or refute him or one or the other. So I consider a rectangular box with one lid, one side free to move. And think of this in three-dimensional space if you want. These people say, well, what you really should be considering is something like this, a long piston with an end there, which eventually you take to infinity.
But you're extending and now the walls.
You're extending the walls. Yeah, that's my point.
In the original
right?
problem, they weren't extending.
Precisely. Now, in the cosmological case, that's clearly what you should do. I think it's clear that this was the right way and this was the wrong way, which he didn't make clear. That's one of the reasons why we wanted to write another paper, because he never quite admitted he was wrong in the first paper. he just said that he was calculating two different situations. But in the cosmological case, if you have compact dimensions, you have compact dimensions, and they're going to be there on the inside of the apparatus or the outside of the apparatus. But here, this is something else. If I want to know what happened in the case of the box, well, this is a case of something that I know how to compute, but what does it tell me about what happens when I take that away? And nothing much, right? I mean, I can always put something out. Whatever I put on the outside is going to change things. To go to a silly extreme, instead of putting the extra shaft on there, I could put another plate there, and then we're going to have attraction between this and this, right? So it'll certainly, from that point of view, it's an even bigger repulsion than you had before. So I think that the rectangular box is still not a...
Yeah, but you could treat the whole problem as a scattering problem, isn't it? I mean, do it differently. You start with two finite plates in a real extreme big box. You have a real big box, and then you have two small finite plates. Mm-hmm. Then you let the big box first go to infinity, and then the plates go to infinity. Mm-hmm. And if you do that calculation, you get the right answer, mm-hmm. at least for force.
Mm-hmm. But what is the right answer in this case? I can argue it.
It's dependent, so there is no universal
what?
Answer.
Mm-hmm. It's what dependent on what?
Cut-off. It's cutoff dependent. Yeah. If you have to deform the bodies to
yeah, but I'm not deforming anything.
So what are you?
So I've got a box without a lid, and then I have a lid that fits in there loosely.
Okay.
Now is it attracted or is it repelled? If you think of it this way, inside a finite finite piston like that, then by this argument, it's still to some crude approximation, it should this effect should still be there, and so it should be attracted, right? And if I put it on the outside, then I would think, well, it's probably attracted to the nearest point, right? So it seems like it should be attracted. But if you do the calculation, I mean, Lukacs' calculation, taken seriously, says it should be repelled. But then, what's happening on the outside? Something very complicated is happening at these corners, presumably.
Yeah.
And nobody really knows how to calculate that. But this work by Milton and his students really began, I think, as an attempt to try to analyze this case. That they ended up not doing that, but doing some other configurations. And they're doing only dilute dielectrics, which means they probably would get the same result as Barton got for the piston where he had the partition being attracted by the distant part of the shaft I wouldn't consider that their perturbative calculation to be particularly relevant to my original question. Any more comments?
Are transmitter forces usually attractive? I mean, between conductors, because you expect that. I mean, you seem to be expecting an answer from some intuition.
Yeah, I think the fair answer is yes. But it's very complicated, and there are other people here who could tell you much more than
I. At least it can be made complicated.
I mean, for symmetric systems and vacuum, yeah,
it's where they go.
It's in general, there's no proof of it, so you don't know.
For symmetric systems.
Yeah. Certainly for a periodic box, there's no general sign. It's one sign for bosons, one for fermions.
Fermions are a different story. We're just looking at bosons. And also, if you have a Dirichlet plate and a Neumann plate, then they repel. And likewise, there's an electromagnetic analog of a perfect conductor and what's called an infinitely permeable plate, where the electric and magnetic boundary conditions change. So, also, there's something very interesting. It started with something I did, just looking at the situation on the line, but using a boundary condition where there's a twist. You have a complex scalar field, and the value here is e to the I theta times the value there. So in other words, it's a line bundle, Hermitian line bundle with a non-trivial holonomy. Then the dependence on that angle is such that you can get either attraction or repulsion. And in fact, if you average over the angle, the average is zero, neither attractive or repulsive, because you're averaging some Bernoulli polynomial whose average is zero. And what my colleagues at A&M, Justin Wilson, John Harrison, and Gregory Berkeleyko, did something similar for general quantum graphs. Where they have and I don't want to get into a long discussion of what a quantum graph is, but they have a scattering matrix for every vertex in the graph, and they randomized over the scattering matrices in the same way that people studying quantum chaos on these graphs do, and they found again that the average was always zero when the average over all possible unitary matrices at the boundaries. And the difference is that if the statistics is of the sort that associates with integrable systems, then the standard deviation is huge. But if it corresponds to the ensemble that applies to chaotic systems, then it's much smaller. So which goes some way toward answering the question of what chaos has to do with vacuum energy. I mean, the naive conjecture was, for several years ago, on my part at least, that if you had a chaotic cavity, then the internal vacuum energy would be much smaller, because the Casimir effect in some sense comes from the bunchiness of the normal modes, and the more integrable you are, the more bunchy you are. And the chaotic, you have a distribution of a spectral density that's closer to empty space. So the vacuum energy ought to be greatly reduced. But it seems that that's not true. It's only the standard deviation that's somehow reduced when you integrate over all possibilities. But it's not clear to me how to extend this quantum graph scattering result to more general situations where cavities or billiards. Because it would appear that probably the closest general analog would be some kind of integration over different boundary conditions, Dirichlet and Neumann on different patches, or maybe a Mopane constant integrated over every randomized on there. But I haven't seen how to generalize the statement, the situation where I was originally interested in.
So I think there's a simple way of answering at least partly your question with this almost closed piston.
Mm-hmm.
And so think that the boundary which is fixed is kind of far away. So the piston is long.
Okay, so we're going to do that?
Yeah, but the left boundary is far.
Okay, so we have got the can here and then the partition far away, just floating in space.
If you write in terms of the energy, in terms of board lines,
mm-hmm.
you know, you can write between some Brownian paths.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Those Brownian paths, it's kind of clear that when your piston is close to the, that your piston wants to be inside, so that
mm-hmm.
you gain both from the left and the right going paths.
Mm-hmm.
So, and at least when the left boundary is kind of far, you can make it precise. Sorry.
I see. You don't mean that this is far away from
from
the can. You mean that
well,
it's close. It's close, but this is far away.
Yeah. So obviously you will gain by going left.
Mm-hmm.
And this you can make precise argument.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Holger Gies and other numerical people should be able to do that. Just put this on the computer in a few minutes and get an answer.
But prove it. I mean, it's just a statement about it's just a probability theory.
Mm-hmm.